Okay, we are just about hitting 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and mute all. And you will have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so. If you have a question or comment, please remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. Reminder that later on this evening, the deck in PDF format, as well as the audio track and the contents of the chat window, will go up on our website. So you can access all of the previous Q&A sessions there. Just a reminder that if we have anybody new with us tonight, if you want to join the group, check the chat for a link where you can go to join the group. Excuse me. And if you join by March 31st, you'll get 2 years for the price of one. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Oops. Okay, thanks very much, Chris. And welcome, everyone. You probably remember that last week I was singing the praises of Microsoft, which is a new experience for me, and in particular, how much I liked file history. So today, Chris is going to tear down all the hope that I built up.
Well, not totally, but I do have a bit of a rant about Windows 11 and file history. So, as Alan said, last week he had a series of slides talking about how to set up file history and what it's good for and so forth. And I agree, the file history is actually a very great utility if you're on Windows 10 or Windows 8. It actually started with Windows 8. Most of the operations can be done through the Settings app. And there are a few things that you can only do through Control Panel. Next. So my rant on this is that Microsoft completely removed file history from the Settings app. Up until now, what they've been doing is migrating more and more things from Control Panel into Settings. And this is the first time that I've actually seen where they removed functionality from the Settings app, but they did leave it in Control Panel. Next. So it's not actually a problem that they move something from Settings to Control Panel, other than people, if they're in a habit of going to Settings, they might not think to look to Control Panel. But as long as I know that it's there, I can find it. So it's not a problem if it can be done in Control Panel. But it turns out that not everything can be done in the Control Panel applet. Most significantly, the ability to add additional folders to be backed up beyond what is the default set of folders is totally gone from the Control Panel applet, as Alan pointed out in last week's presentation. Next. So the following slides, you really only have to be worried about these if you're on Windows 11 and you want to use file history, although I'm going to go through a few things about using libraries that I think probably a lot of people may find functionality in the use of libraries that maybe you hadn't thought about before. And you might want to investigate those. So first off, I have a slide here talking about moving file history drive, your backup drive with the file history on it, to a new computer. And this is where I first ran into the problem as I was setting up my new Windows 11 computer. So if you are moving a file history drive, backup drive, from an old computer on Windows 10 or Windows 8, and you're going to a Windows 11 computer, first off, everything that was backed up using file history while it was on the previous computer is actually still recoverable. So you may have years' worth of old versions of files that you can still access if you move it according to the instructions that are given in the link there. It has step-by-step how you have to go about doing it. As it turns out, I actually talked about this at Q&A on May 25th of last year as well. So that link is in the chat as well. So next. So the critical thing is that Microsoft actually purposefully broke file history in Windows 11, and that's what really pisses me off. They didn't have to do that, but they did. So as it turns out now, only libraries, desktops, your desktop contents, contacts and favorites, which contacts, I don't know anybody who actually uses those contacts, they get backed up by file history moving forwards, even if you move that file history drive from another computer where it was backing up other things. It's only going to back up going forward, libraries, contact, or desktop contacts and favorites. So there's no Settings app for file history, so you can only use Control Panel to configure file history. Next.
So, Chris, when you say libraries, does that mean things like pictures and videos?
Yep.
And libraries?
Yep, and I'll be coming to that and talking about that extensively as we go forward in here. So, next. So, in the Control Panel applet, you do have that option to exclude folders. Next. But there's no option to add folders, and that really ticks me off because I have all my data files on another drive. Next. But notice that it does back up libraries, and that's the key to everything. Next. So libraries are the rescue for the fact that Microsoft actually broke Windows file history by taking it out of the settings app. So it does back up all libraries by default. And libraries are simply pointers to one or more locations. The default libraries are documents, pictures, music, and videos, and they are all, those libraries contain a single folder each that are off your main profile directory. So it'd be, in my case, /c:\users\ctaylor\documents. That's the only folder that's in the documents library. The music library contains a single folder, which is /users\ctaylor\music, and so forth. So, but a library can contain any number of folders located anywhere, on any drive, any location, any name. Next. So to back up those additional folders using file history, all you have to do is add them to a library, and that'll do the trick for you. Now, you can add them to an existing library, or I suggest that probably best is create a brand new library that is only used for your file history folders that you want to back up, and it helps keep things organized by keeping them in that one library, and then you know all those additional locations that are being backed up by file history. Next. So if for working with libraries, you go into File Manager, and by default, libraries don't actually show up. They're supposed to show up in that bottom left-hand corner of the left-hand pane, and they're not there by default. So next, you click on the ellipsis, next, and then the menu that pops up, you go to Options, next, and then you'll get into the Folders Options dialog box, and on the View tab, you click on the box for Show Libraries, and then they will show up. Next. So now we see the library listing on the left-hand side down near the bottom. So to create a new library, right-click where it says Libraries, and in the menu that pops up, you say Show More Options. Now, if you're on Windows 10, you don't actually need to do this, but if you did it on Windows 10, it'll end up on one menu. On Windows 11, they have this stupid option. You have to show more options rather than just getting all your options in one list. So you click on Show More Options, next, and you'll get another menu, and then that's where you can click on New and select Library, next. And in File Manager, File Explorer tradition, like when you create a new folder, it'll come up with New Folder. In this case, it comes up with New Library, and it's highlighted, so you can just start typing in a name for it. Or if you accidentally click off it and you end up with this library called New Library, you can right-click on it and rename it. So I suggest call it something like File History Areas or something like that. Next. So then what you do is you navigate to the folder that you want to back up using file history. So in this case, I've navigated to on my D drive, data directory, documents, photography. And I've decided that I want to back up this particular folder using file history. So I just navigate to that folder, right-click on the folder, and in the menu that pops up, go to Show More Options, and then next, in the menu that pops up from there, you'll have an option to Include in Library, and then next, you select the library you want to add it to. So in my case, I'm going to add it to that one called File History Areas. So that's really all you have to do in order to have things getting backed up by file history. And from then on, that folder will be backed up by file history automatically. You go through all of the different folders that you want to add in to have file history back up, go through the steps on this slide, and you'll have them all backed up then. So fairly straightforward, but my rant is that I think Microsoft went out of their way to break it. And I think that that's unconscionable. So I was searching out about this problem and solutions and whether this was a permanent thing or whatever. And I went to the Microsoft Answers Forum, and one of the moderators there said that file history has been deprecated. Now, Microsoft's definition of deprecation, I looked it up, and this is how they define it. So it means we intend to remove the feature or capability from a future release. The feature or capability will continue to work and is fully supported. So if you have any bugs or whatever, presumably they'll fix them until it is officially removed. And it can take months or years before, or maybe Microsoft will reverse course on it. And then after removal, feature or capability will no longer work. So at some point, file history might completely disappear. I don't know. And I've not seen anything outside of the Microsoft Answers Forum that talked about this being deprecated or the fact that it is going away or anything like that. But for now, I think it really, really works well. It provides you with near real-time backup of all your important data files. You just got to add those folders containing those files, and you'll get them backed up. Potentially, you can have years' worth of versions of files. So you can go back and you say, oh, I've been working on this document for the last year, and I really want to look at what did this document look like last week or last month or last year or 2 years ago or whatever. And they're all very easily recoverable. I asked the question, you know, why deprecate file history? And they haven't replaced it with anything that has similar functionality at all on that. I have complained about this in the feedback hub. I don't know that that will actually help at all, but there are a number of complaints in the feedback hub, so maybe Microsoft will revive file history and bring it back into the settings app where it was a lot easier to deal with. And that's all I have for file history.
Okay, thanks, Chris. There's nothing, no comments in the chat, so we'll carry on. And I'd like to talk a little bit about hidden files. And you probably remember that I'd said that Macrium Reflect, the free edition, was going to be not supported in another year or so, I think. And so I started looking for a replacement, and I tried out ESIS to do backup, which is the backup, the disk imaging program that, that Chris favors and has written newsletter articles about. And so I tried it, and I didn't actually really like it. So I actually removed it from my system. The other program I use a lot, instead of file history, I use FreeFileSync, which is a manual. I use it in a manual method where once I finished a computer session, I stick in my external USB flash drive, run FileSync, FreeFileSync, and it basically tells me what files are new and what have changed and what I've deleted, and offers to copy them to the external drive. And here you see the screenshot, and suddenly these two files at the top there popped up. And eumonbmp.sys, and then something with a long string of digits and a .cbm. And I hadn't seen these files before, and I didn't really know what they were. So rather than just go ahead and copy them to the external drive or maybe change it to be deleted, I decided to go into File Explorer and have a look and see what they were. And so I went into File Explorer, and you can see the files listed underneath the folders. And you may notice that those two files don't show up there, which is a little strange. Especially because in the top right-hand corner here, you can see that I've got hidden items checked. So if they were hidden files, they still should be showing up. So that's a little odd. So the next thing I tried was to boot into Linux on my dual boot machine. And sure enough, when I look at that data drive on Linux, the two files are clearly visible. So something is really strange about these two files, and it turns out I checked with Chris, and they do actually belong to ESIS to do backup. And so I actually don't want them, but I still wondered why they don't show up. So if you go into File Explorer and click on the View tab, and then go to Options, And you can go into the change folders and search options. You'll see here that I've checked show hidden files and folders. That was checked previously. But notice that there's another item here. Hide protected operating system files recommended. I haven't actually noticed that previously. If I uncheck that and unhide protected operating system files, then suddenly in File Explorer, my two files show up. So this is what I consider to be super hidden files. They're, you can check on hidden files, but these guys won't show up because they're actually hidden system files. So if you run into this problem, that's the way to get around it. And you notice that I used Linux to have a look at what was going on, and of course Linux has a much cleaner display of its file system. You can see here there's just a few folders and a few files on my home directory. But is that really true? Supposing I were to just hit Control and S, that display would suddenly change, and you would find there's a whole bunch of folders with a dot in front of it, and a whole bunch of files with a dot in front of them, and these are all hidden files. So the Control and S is a toggle to switch to turn hidden files on and off. Normally I have it off, which is why I get the so-called clean display. But Linux is good at hiding files and stuff too, so I can't really blame Windows too much. Except I only need one hidden file thing to do it in Linux. Okay, nothing else there, I don't think. So we'll go on to another interesting slide from Chris.
Yeah, back on November 2nd, I had a slide about Microsoft 365 and their branded Oreo cookies. Well, I ran into another one. I have to chuckle at these. I really wonder what Microsoft is spinning their wheels on. You can actually get Minecraft branded Crocs. So if you want Crocs with little buildings on them and things like that, if you go to the URL on the screen, and I will paste that into the chat as well, you can actually get yourself a set of Microsoft branded or Minecraft, which is owned by Microsoft, branded Crocs. That's all I have on that.
Well, we should all sign up for one of those, I think. Okay, one of the suggestions that came in for a topic, I think it was actually Jeff Dubois. He was interested in what browser extensions people find useful, and in particular, which extensions people use with which browsers. So I put this question in the members only forum and got a whole bunch of replies. So I'm going to go through the replies now, and I'll just mention briefly what I think about the extensions. And if the people who suggested them want to chip in further, please do so. So the first one that came in was from Harvey, and he mentioned Adblocker Ultimate. He says it's the only browser extension that he uses. He uses it in Firefox, Edge, and Chrome. And all of these browsers are configured to use Adblocker, and clearly they do a good job because they're blocking ads, as indicated by the graphic there. So if you're interested in blocking ads, that's a well-traveled option. Jeff uses a slightly different version, uBlock Origin. It's not just an ad blocker, it actually does more things. It also blocks trackers and coin miners and things that pop up. And it has a whole bunch of filters. And it's particularly processor and memory efficient. And at least it runs on Firefox. Jeff gives us a link here for the Firefox option. Jeff also uses a VPN extension. Strong VPN is his VPN of choice. And again, this is one of these things that will allow you to forestall geo-blocking and give you some degree of privacy if you're in a public website internet service at a coffee shop, that kind of thing. And he said it's quick. And in this particular case, there's a Chrome extension for it. Stuart, over in the deepest, darkest Shwinigan there, reads a lot of French text. And he has an extension for Google Translate, which I always thought was just an app. But apparently you can plug it in as a browser extension. And on the Chromebox, the extension automatically translates everything that's in French to English. And on the Windows device, you just have to left click on the extension and tell it to translate, and then it will do so. Translate's a really useful option. It's got a lot better in the past years too. And then if you're interested in trying to avoid advertising, Google Analytics opt-out is an add-on that you can try. It basically tells Google Analytics not to send information to Google. Stuart says he doesn't know whether it works or not, but he likes the idea that it minimizes advertising and search results and feeding back to Google. Jeff noted JavaScript toggle on and off is the actual app. And I used to use this. I use this one too. It basically switches JavaScript on and off in the browser. And by default, JavaScript stays enabled. So you have to click the toolbar if you want to disable it. And I used to use it a lot because I'd go to websites and they would pop up videos and music playing. And if I turned off JavaScript, then that prevented that from happening. These days, I don't see that anymore. So I don't know whether it's now built into my browser, which gets updated every 2 days, I think. But if you're running into those kind of problems, this is a really neat little toggle to stop JavaScript from running just temporarily. Because some sites need JavaScript to feedback results. So if something doesn't work, maybe remember that you've got JavaScript toggled off. And then the final one from Jeff is a Facebook app, FB Purity. Basically has a whole bunch of features that cleans up junk on Facebook for those of you who use Facebook. And now we have a couple of browser options, which I'll let Chris talk about.
I use about a handful extensions in my browsers, and so I'll cover just a couple of them. Behind the overlay is kind of a cool one. So an example of that is when you get to a website and you get this big thing that pops up, and you don't necessarily want to answer the questions on it or whatever. It might be asking a survey or who knows what, but you can't see the web page behind it. You can click on the web page and it doesn't work and things like that. So next. So what you do is you click on the icon for behind the overlay when it's been installed, or you can just hold down Control Shift X, next, and poof, the overlay will be gone. Now, it doesn't work on all types of pop-ups, so there are some things that this is not going to get rid of, but I find it very handy to have it there. I just use the Control Shift X. If it doesn't go away, I'm no worse off than I was before. Next. So you can get it for any of the Chromium browsers. And I will mention that all of the other ones that were for designed for Google Chrome, if you go to the Chrome Web Store with another browser that is based on Chromium, you will actually be able to add the extension to that particular browser as well. So if any Chromium browsers such as Chrome, Edge, Brave, Opera, and so forth, you can get it at that. And then Firefox, because it's a different architecture, they do have this behind the overlay available for it as well. These links are all in the chat window as well. Next. The other one that I use a lot is the Camelizer, and kudos to Bob Harris for mentioning about this a number of years ago. It gives you a price history at Amazon, and it'll be Amazon.ca, so it'll be Canadian prices and so forth. And if you want, you can set alerts if you set up a free account. But you can get the price history without even setting up an account if you want. So here I have an example. I'm looking at a book, and I see that the current price is, what is it, $28.25. And next, if I hit the Camelizer icon, I'll actually get this graph of what the price has been over a period of time. And I can select a period of time, or it defaults to all prices that it has on the site. And I can see here that it's actually pretty near a high price on that. So if I wasn't in a rush to get this book, I might want to wait for it to, because it's almost certain, I think, to be coming down in price at some point. So I just wait. Now, I did actually go and create an account with the Camelizer. And so I can use that bottom portion where I can actually put in a price. So I could say, okay, I want an Amazon price. I want you to alert me when the price has dropped to, you know, whatever I want, 20 bucks or whatever. And then I'll get an email if the price ever drops to that particular level. I think that's really cool. It helps me save a bunch of money at Amazon. And next. So you can get it for Firefox or for any of the Chromium browsers. That's it.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And Tom mentions that uBlock Origin, as well as being an ad blocker and so forth, it can also block JavaScript. So it truly is multi-featured. Okay, moving along, Chris has a computer basics item on zooming web pages.
Yeah, so you may find that whenever you're browsing on the web that the page is, the text is too large or it's too small, or you want to make it larger or want to make it smaller. Well, all of the major browsers, all web browsers that I know of, let you zoom in and zoom out on pages. And the way you get to it is usually you click the menu, which is either a hamburger menu or it's three dots, either vertically or horizontally. Nobody seems to be able to standardize on this. And then you'll get a pop-up menu, and there will be a zoom option on that where you can choose to zoom in, zoom out, and so forth. Next. And Opera went its own way, so they have the Opera menu or the O menu over in the left-hand side. And if you click on the O menu, you will have that option to zoom in or zoom out on the page. Next. You can do it that way, but I find it actually a lot faster to just use the keyboard. Next. You can use Control Plus to zoom in, Control Minus to zoom out, and Control Zero to bring it back to 100%. So very, very handy to just do it with the keyboard. Now, it used to be that that only worked if you had a numeric keypad. It had to be the plus and minus on the numeric keypad to zoom in and zoom out. And they've since fixed that up probably years ago at this point, but I just noticed it recently. So next. It'll work with either the numeric keypad or the number row above the letters. Now, you don't have to use the shift key because you notice that the plus is actually on, it's a shifted key. So it's equals and the plus is on it. So you might think that you'd have to do, oh, control shift and that key. No, you don't. You just have to do the control and that particular key that has equal and plus on it, and it will do the zoom in that particular case. So I find that really, really handy for zooming. So the zoom range, it varies a little bit between browsers, but generally there's five sizes that are below 100%. So 30, 50, 67, 80, 90. And then there are 10 zoom ranges that are above 100% going up to 500%. Seems to be what they all standardized on as the maximum zooming on the page. Next. So if you're using a Chromium-based browser, so again, Chrome, Edge, Brave, Opera, you will get, when you change the zoom, you will get a brief pop-up that shows you what the current zoom is, and it has the plus and the minus and the reset on there as well. So if you're pretty quick, you can actually click on the plus or minus as well to zoom in or zoom out or reset it to 100%, but it disappears pretty quick. Next. Fortunately, if you're zoomed at anything other than 100%, you will get an actual icon at the right-hand edge of the URL bar, and you can click on that, and it'll bring that zoom box back to you. Again, you could just be using your keystrokes if you wanted instead, but if you wanted to use the mouse, that's a very fast and easy way to get to the ability to zoom in, zoom out, or do a reset. Next. And then... If you are zoomed in or zoomed out, the icon that you see there will actually show you whether you're zoomed in or zoomed out. So if you see the magnifying glass with a plus sign on it, it means that you are zoomed in on the page currently, so you're at something over 100%. If you see a minus in that little magnifying glass, it means that you are at a zoom range currently at something less than 100%. Next. And Firefox, because it's not Chromium-based, they go their own way. In one case, I think it's actually kind of nice. If you're zoomed at anything other than 100%, you will see the zoom value in the URL bar, and it stays there. It doesn't disappear on you. But if you click it, it would just return you to 100%, doesn't give you that option to zoom in or zoom out. So a little bit different, but I kind of like the idea that it leaves it on the screen all the time. Now, some other programs will actually support that idea of Control Plus to zoom in, Control Minus to zoom out, and Control Zero to reset the zoom to 100%. A lot of photo editing programs will let you zoom in and zoom out on the image or reset it to 100%. There are some other programs. So if you like that idea of being able to zoom in and zoom out, check it out in the other programs that you use to see whether it actually does something or not. And I think that's it.
Serge likes your tip for zooming. Micheline says, what about control and the mouse wheel? And Jeff says, generally it's the quickest if you can use control mouse.
Yeah, I mean, some programs will support it. And in a browser, let me just try here. It does work in the browser as well. But I've always found that if I'm hitting the control key, it means my hands are on the keyboard. So I just use the control plus, control minus personally. But yeah, it looks like that works as well in the browser, and it will work in some other programs as well.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. So next up, we have a couple of Android apps that Stuart likes. And if Stuart's voice is up to it tonight, he can talk about it. If you unmute himself, there we go.
Okay, I think I'm here. There's no coughing noises at the moment anyway. I came across Sunbird a couple months ago, actually. And despite the fact that I message almost none, it intrigued me because it's proposing to integrate all messaging applications under one roof, so to speak. That would be wonderful if it happened, because if you've got Skype and you can't talk to Telegram and you've got somebody on iMessage and somebody in Boogie Boo or whatever, there's a whole raft of different messaging platforms, and it kind of sucks talking to people that aren't on the same one as you. But this one's great reason for being is iMessage on Android, because the great divide in the world seems to be Apple and Android. So trying to bring those two under one roof is what this is all about in the beginning. And you can tell which one is which because the little message bubble is a different color. Which one that is, I forget. I don't know what color they are. But apparently there's quite a bit of snobbery around this. Apple people won't talk to people from Android if their bubble pops up because it's not the right color. And goodness gracious, we can't have them in here. Well, with this application, Sunbird, it should be called Chameleon, actually. It makes the bubble the same color as the iMessage. So they don't know they're talking to a semi-mechanical biological construct. Right, there's a spy in the orchard. Anyway, it's supposed to work. And all you've got to do is first be accepted into the little test. Here goes my voice. The test group that is running the application, you have to apply to get into it. And then you have to create an Apple ID and use that with the Sunbird Android app. And the Apple ID is kind of Apple's golden passport to all things Apple. If you don't have any Apple devices, you create a fake one. And off you go. And this is where it gets a little tricky, because One of the references, a YouTuber was talking about Sunbird, saying there is a risk that they don't know if Apple is going to approve the use of its Apple ID with this application. And if they disapprove of it, well, anybody using this may have that account trashed. So if you're using a real Apple ID with this, your whole Apple account could get trashed. And if you would plan to use the fake Apple ID with real Apple products in the future, it won't work. So there's some 50 of this and half a dozen of the other going on here at the moment with it. But anyway, if it is approved, that's all peachy and keen and wonderful. And where are we in the process now? This is early 2023. They have publicly launched, and they're moving into, they want to move into Facebook and WhatsApp and other things now. And by the end of the year, they plan on moving into all the various other Android and Microsoft platforms. So it's one to watch, is what I would say at the moment. I wouldn't invest in it myself, because actually I've got an iPad now and I have an Apple ID, and I don't need a fake Apple ID. I'm probably going to get an iPhone next too, so I can be one of those snobs. But I see this as potentially a really great platform if successful, and something to keep an eye on for integrating your messaging amongst all your friends on different platforms, or friends in business contexts. Can't forget those business contacts. But who knows? It may get bought up by Google, amalgamated into their system, and told not to talk to Apple in the long run anyway. But if Google does that, there's still a good chance they may want to integrate all the other Android messaging platforms. So, Sunbird, we don't know exactly where this bird is going yet. Keep your eye on it, folks. Did that make sense?
Sounds good. So moving okay. on.
Hang on, fake beer pause. One of the websites I follow, Android Authority, once a week puts out a little list of handy Android apps for people to try out. Unfortunately, they're usually games, which I'm not interested in, but last week they had one that is sort of a reference on cryptocurrency. It's not, it's just a reference. It's not about buying or selling. It's about knowing what the different cryptos are and what they're worth in your country's currency or other countries, other countries' currencies. And I put it on my crash test dummy tablet here, and it hasn't broken anything yet. It hasn't tried to sell me anything. It's a nifty little reference to tell you about many different cryptocurrencies, where they are in the market at the moment, statistics on each one, its history, where it's from. It's kind of like the Merlin app for birds, you know. It doesn't catch you a bird. It just tells you all about the different birds that are out there. Unfortunately, I don't know what calls cryptocurrency makes, like bird calls in Merlin. It doesn't have those audio files. So I don't know. I suppose cryptocurrency would make a ka-ching kind of sound. But there are so many different cryptos out there, and most people of my generation, yeah, you younger folks probably know more about it than I do, but most folks we don't know what the heck's going on with this stuff. So this is a great little reference tool to try and edumacate ourselves a little bit further on what's going on in the currency of the future.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, remember, Canada doesn't have any gold reserves anymore. We're flying on digital wishes at the moment anyway. But cryptoanalogy. Analogy? How do you say that? Cryptoanalogy. Should be crypto coin reference. It's an interesting little app to take a look at and learn a little more about digital currencies.
Okay.
That's all I've got. My voice hasn't quite died on me yet. So.
Very good. Thanks. Thanks very much, Stuart.
You're welcome.
So if I can change the slide here. Of course, it doesn't want to go.
It'll cost you a Bitcoin to change the slide.
Oh, you jumped ahead a whole bunch.
Yeah, why though? There we are. Okay. I'm trying to use Chris's trick of just hitting the slide number, but it went to the end of the slides for some reason. Okay, a while ago, I think again, Jeff suggested that it would be interesting to talk about managing context menus. So I put out the call on the members only forum and nobody stepped forward. So I thought I'd take a look. A long time ago, I tried a program called MenuMade, which gave me access to the context menu. And it worked pretty well. It was pretty simple. It was run by some fanatical religious organization. You'll still find it listed on the web, but I tried downloading it from a third-party site, and it didn't work in Windows 10, so I suspect that's not supported anymore. Anyway, context menu. So this is what happens when you right-click on some item, for example, a file in Windows Explorer, File Explorer. You right-click on a file, and a menu pops up of things that you can do. And there's an example on the right-hand side there of various things that pop up when you do that. When you install programs, when you install software, they love to add themselves to this menu. So the context menu gets longer and longer. And the question is, how do you get control back? And for example, if you look at that list, there's a context menu item there for Power Rename. Well, I don't recall ever using Power Rename, but I probably did because it turns out it's one of the Power Toys, and I certainly installed Power Toys. I used their image resize program quite a bit. I don't remember using the renamer, but there it is. Anyway, I don't use it, so the question is, how do I delete it? Well, of course, the answer is, Mr. Google, he knows how to delete it. So if you put in a question like edit context menu, you get a whole bunch of links, and most of them will tell you that there's really two methods. One method is edit the registry. And we all love to dive into the registry because we have absolutely no idea what's in there. It seems to be incredibly complicated. And unless you know which keys you're trying to find, it's almost an impossible task to do anything. But you have to find somebody on the web who knows how to do the thing that you want and give you the key and tell you exactly how to modify it or delete it or update it or whatever. And so that's not a particularly good option. The other way to do it is to use a third-party program. And that's what I'd used before, this MenuMade, which I say now it doesn't seem to exist. But there's a whole raft of them which people will tell you should work. Crap Cleaner, for example, NIRSoft, a program called Easy Context Menu Tuner. I tried CCleaner, and I couldn't find the entry for Power Renamer, so that didn't help me. I tried Easy Context Menu, and that was a disaster. So I turned to this NIRSoft because I've used some of their utilities previously and they work quite well. And the other thing about it is it tells you about two different utilities, Shell Menu View and Shell X View. And when you look at those two things, Now, show menu view says it will disable and enable context menu items. And ShellX view is an extensions manager, which sounds somewhat similar because it lets you disable and enable shell extensions. So this is text speak, which I don't fully understand the differences there. But anyway, you dive in and see what happens. So I tried shell menu view because that was the first one and I couldn't find my option. So I tried shell X view and ended up with a huge list of items. But browsing down through the list here, if you hover over the, first of all, you select the one that you want to get rid of. So I'm interested in power rename shell extension. Notice that it says it's disabled. It's interesting. I must have done this after I disabled it. But basically, if you hover over this guy up here, then it's disable the selected item. It pops up this menu. Do you want to disable power rename shell extension? I say, yes, I do want to disable it. And now you see the before and after. So here's the context menu before I did anything. And then here's the context menu. And you can see that power rename has disappeared between these other two items here. So that third party utility does in fact remove the context menu item once I disabled it. So if you want to get rid of some things on your context menu, then there's a couple of ways to do it. And basically, you need to use Google to find out exactly how to get rid of things that you want to get rid of, I think. So now I'll try and switch back to there. Well, now we're just outside of the last 10 minutes. So the question is, does anybody have any other questions that they would like to answer? Or do you have anything else you'd like to share or discuss or whatever? So Serge Eric is saying, if anyone discovers a context menu editor that gives you the option to group items, let us know. Micheline wants to know, how about adding programs to the context menu? Well, yes, I think these menu editing programs or menu managing programs let you add and delete some of them. From my perspective, I always have way too many menu context menu items. I'm happy to delete them. I never want to add them. Okay, don't all shout at once. While we're waiting, I'll just say a couple of things that are coming up. First of all, we do have a special offer on membership if you're not a member or if you know somebody who would like to be a member. The board has decided that members in good standing, hey, paid-up members as of March the 31st, will have their membership extended for an extra year, absolutely free of charge. So if you're not a member right now, but you join before, you join now, or at least before March 31st, give us your $20, your hard-earned $20 per year. On March the 31st, you'll be a member in good standing, and then your membership will be extended for an additional year. So essentially, if you join now, you're essentially buying 2 years membership for the $20 price of 1 year. So that's a two-for-one that shouldn't be missed. Second thing, coming up on March the 8th is our regular monthly meeting. And by special request, we've got Paul and Maria coming back from the Trailing Edge. And this time, they're going to be talking about mending things. Tales from the computer workbench. So, how to fix things, what kind of things that they see in the store, what kind of things that they regularly fix. And hopefully they're going to share some of the techniques that we can use to avoid having to take it into the shop. So that might be a really interesting presentation. Okay, I still don't see anything in the chat window, so I don't know whether people have things that they want to talk about or not.
Just one comment on the uBlock extension.
Yes, go ahead.
The what I noticed with it is where it's what it's also handy at blocking is advertisements in the middle of videos. I regularly catch. I use CBC Gem because I watch things on demand as opposed to, oh, it's 8 o'clock, turn the TV on. And on the CBC Gem player, unless you have the premium view, you're inundated with commercials the same way you would be on television. But if you stream on the CBC Gem, if you have an account on Gem, a free account, and you have the uBlock extension, it seems to me that it strips all the commercials. So that's quite nice.
What about YouTube, Jeff? Does it do anything for that?
I haven't fully tested it. I just I posted a thing in the forum about adding a dash to the address, and it strips all the addresses. If you enter a dash between the, I believe it's the B and the E in YouTube, and you'll get the video with no ads. But I believe the uBlock will do the same thing in YouTube. I believe it will. I haven't tested it yet, though. I can get back to you next week on that.
I didn't try that that tip that you had because I don't use YouTube very much, but that sounds really weird, putting a hyphen in the URL.
I tried that, and it works. Yeah, it's great.
Really?
Yeah, it does. It works really. That's why I put the two links in the message, one with the dash and one without. Yeah, it's a pretty weird fix. It's no idea why, but it's kind of a weird one.
So that posting is on the members only forum. If you're an OBCUG member, you can go look for that. It's from Jeff Dubois. Maybe we'll try and incorporate that next week. And in the meantime, Micheline's put a couple of links in the chat window. If you're interested in context menu editors, there's the 15 best for Windows 10 and 11, and also the 10 best for Windows Tweak Library. So there's a whole raft of options there you can take a look at. Some of them I noticed are the ones I talked about, CCleaner and Shell Menu View and Easy Context Menu. But certainly they're worth a try. They're all freeware, so try them out. They work fine. If they don't, just move on to the next.
I wanted to suggest a potential topic. one of the mobile phone channels I follow has a feature called After the Buzz, where they will look at a device they reviewed perhaps a year or a year and a half after its release and say, so how is this thing held up? And I was going to suggest perhaps people who have presented apps or devices or anything, what have you, are you on the old pug, are you still using them? And if so, do they still work? I know there's a few Android apps I've kicked to the curb, and there's a few that I still use, and I'm sure there's other folks that have presented things to the club that may or may not still be using those things. But
yeah,
sort of
good
a looking.
Good point to those too, because I find the same thing that, you know, I may be really enthusiastic about something and then it doesn't age well. So, you know, doing an update where I say, yeah, this is why I don't think it's quite so good anymore. Not a bad idea, yeah.
He's not referencing me. I age very well.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know, we couldn't call it After the Buzz because that was taken, but we call it, you know, past warranty or...
we can call it whatever we want.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think there's any copyright on the term.
Yeah, the other aspect of that, of course, is that when you find that something doesn't work very well, you move on and find something that does. So it's like an update maybe too.
Yeah. Yeah, good idea, Sue. Yeah.
And so Bob Harris notes that he tried the YouTube Dash and it works really well. So thanks, Jeff.
I find it's interesting, though, if you use that the Dash, it actually rewrites the whole URL, and it creates an enormously long URL. But if you go, like if you try to pass on a link to somebody else, if you take the regular URL, YouTube URL, just add the Dash in it, give it to the person, when they, you know, go to that link, it will rewrite itself into a long URL, but it'll work.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. I gave a presentation a while back on an extension called Video Download Helper, where you can download videos from YouTube. And the curious thing is, if you're watching the video while you're downloading it, it might be full of ads, but the actual download doesn't have any of the ads in it.
Interesting.
Oh, that's a useful app.
Yeah. The only thing I sort of wondered a little bit about is that content creators that are using YouTube, you know, they can be getting paid. And I wonder if you use the Dash technique there, are you removing that revenue from that viewing? Now, any one viewing is probably worth, you know, hundreds of a penny or something to the person. You know, I just sort of wondered, it's just curiosity across my mind, was whether the person was still getting revenue if you remove the ads when you're watching it. I don't know.
I don't think so. Actually, I just saw one YouTuber break down his revenue stream. Because he was all ticked off by YouTube's promoting the use of shorts and saying that he didn't get diddly. He was getting shorted on his shorts as well and wasn't going to create anymore. And he compared how what his revenue stream from shorts was versus his regular stuff. And it essentially comes down to how many minutes people watch of the video.
Okay. And, so nothing to do with the ads that are displayed. I guess YouTube is just assuming that people are having the ads foisted on them. So
yeah, they already got the money from the advertisers. They don't give a shit.
True.
Micheline is just noting that when she quotes a URL, she usually deletes everything after the question mark, and it still works. And I've noticed that too. A lot of the links for the Play Store tend to be quite long. But usually you don't need a whole bunch of the stuff at the end. I never figure it out, but that's a useful tip if you're trying to use shortened URLs. You don't necessarily need the whole thing.
The one thing that you probably don't want to take out is if you ever want to direct a person to a YouTube video at a particular point, like at 10 minutes, 15 seconds or whatever, and you pause the video at that point and you right-click, you get an option to give a URL at that time, and it includes an S equals and number of seconds into the video. So leave that portion on there. You can get rid of other things that are their parameters for doing other things. But if you leave that on, when the person gets it, the video will actually pick up from that point in the video.
Yeah, you know, that's a technique I didn't know about, too.
Speaking of URLs and URL shortening, I had the need to send a link to someone that was extremely long. And I tried to use the Google URL shortener, and it appears that it's no longer available to the public. Now, I don't know when that changed, but it used to be very easily accessible. You just go to the Google URL shortener and generate one, but it's no longer the case. So I don't know if formerly created short URLs that I've embedded in a website even work anymore. Something I haven't had time to check.
Tiny URL is still working as far as I know. So.
Well, although some people have complained that using the tiny URL to get to Q&A or regular meetings failed on them. And I'm, you know, the URL, it's the full URL actually works. So it's there. Some people's ability to get to tiny URL is somehow been impeded. I don't know. It's pretty bizarre.
Bitly.com still works. We need to get the full, the longer URL and add it to the reminder notice.
Yeah, I did it this week for the one that I send out on the weekend. I included the full URL as well, and I'll try to remember to do that going forward for all meetings as well.
And I will pull that off for the reminder notices as well.
Yeah.
Bitly.com still works.
Yeah, Bitly.com, you have to create an account if you want a custom URL. I didn't bother with that because Bitly or Tiny URL, you don't actually have to create an account in order to create a custom URL, which we wanted was OPCUG meeting, as the URL. So I never bothered using Bitly to do that.
You may need an account, but you don't need to pay anything. It's still free.
No, I know. Yeah, I know.
I noticed tonight that I couldn't get the tiny URL working in the email, but when I went to your website and clicked on the tiny URL there for Q&A, it worked fine.
Now, that's weird.
I know. Just thought I'd mention that.
Yeah, no, thanks. It's
I used the tiny URL off the website tonight.
Okay, you did too. Okay.
Yeah.
Good to know.
Are you using a webmail ad blocker?
No.
Maybe I'll have to bite the bullet and create a Bitly one.
Linda, when you were using the off the email, were you using webmail or mail client?
I was using a mail client.
Okay.
Somebody's trying to tell us something.
The hockey game's on.
B, are you trying to communicate?
Sorry, I was just going to say mine work through the through the email.
The email, yeah.
And when Chris and I tried it after the meeting, it worked fine too. So
yeah,
really weird.
I don't understand.
We'll try and include both links in the future, and hopefully one of them will work.
Yeah.
It could be because I'm still using my old Simpatico account. Could it, rather than the Gmail? I haven't tried linking from Gmail.
It shouldn't make any difference, but it's a pretty easy URL. So if you just make a note of it, you can manually type it into your browser if you want to. That was the whole purpose I set it up for, was that, you didn't have to have it written down. You'd be able to remember it. But I don't know. Very strange. Okay, well, I think we are running through the, we are past the 8:30, so I think we could go ahead and call quits for tonight. So thanks very much for everybody for showing up and good input during the last 10. And we'll see you next week at Q&A.
And if you have questions, don't forget to send them to suggestion box. Thank you.